Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and welcome to our UFO show from upstate New York. At his home, we have Richard Dolan. Richard is a major, major icon in the UFO business. How are you, Rich?
Hi, Jerry. Thanks for having me on. And next time anyone calls me a major icon, I know that you did it first.
Well, you know, I started not to call you a major icon because it kind of sounds like you're like me on your last legs.
I hope not. I hope neither of us are.
Well, I hope I'm not either.
Exactly. But that was very, very nice of you to say that, and you just made my evening.
First of all, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that you know how to celebrate New Year's Eve. You went to Philadelphia.
Wow, I sure did. And
hey, actually, it was a good cause, right?
Yes, absolutely. It was a fundraiser for a local library, nonprofit kind of a event. And I was asked, Karen Dolan, my wife, was asked to go down there. And Peter Robbins, all of us gave presentations for a local Philadelphia MUFON-oriented group. And it was very, very pleasant. It was very nice. You know, a lot of these small gatherings that I'll do large and I'll do small ones. And the small ones are really nice because, A, you really get to talk to a lot of the folks one-on-one. And typically there's just a lot of engaged, very interested people. And it was a very nice experience for sure. And
yeah, it was a very good cause, I guess, a public access channel, a show there that you were helping to benefit?
Absolutely, that's right. That's exactly right. It was organized. A lot of it was really initiated by my very good friend Jennifer Stein, who is one of the most energetic and just good people working in the field of ufology. Jen's work is more behind the scenes. She's not a researcher, but wow, can she get things done. And if you're ever looking to have an event planned, she is a go-to gal for sure. And in Pennsylvania, she's really been responsible for a lot of very well-produced conferences that have been down there. And one thing I will add is that I spent New Year's Eve with Karen and Peter, and my kids were with me, Mike and Elaine, who are teenagers now, at the home of a family of magicians, and I was sawed in half on New Year's Eve.
So it actually happened to you, huh? They got you in the box and moved the saw around?
It did the whole thing. I laid down on a table, and there was like this little thing that was put over me, and there was this electric saber saw, and it just went right through me. Fortunately, I didn't look down too much because everyone said that it looked terrifying. But I came out of it.
I don't know if I should ask you too much about it. We don't want to give away any secrets. But
I don't know the secret, so I don't think the magician would tell me if I did ask. But I will say that the father, this is done by the son, but the father, who's pretty active in MUFON also in Pennsylvania, is a highly accomplished magician, highly accomplished. And he's taught his son a lot of really cool tricks, too, so we had a good time.
Now, when you saw people in half, they pull that box that you're in apart.
We didn't do that.
And you can see your feet wiggling on one side, and did that happen to you?
No, well, this is in the living room of a home, so it wasn't quite as high-tech as on stage. but it was very well done, I will say that. It was very well done.
Well, we started out talking about television. We ended up about magic, and there's something magical about television and video, and I noticed you're doing a lot of TV work these days.
Well, I don't really know what's appearing on TV. I actually very seldom watch myself on TV. I know there's always clips getting on there. I've just been shot for a couple of recently shot for a few things that will be on History Channel. One, an episode of Ancient Aliens. Did a lot of video for Ancient Aliens a couple of months ago, and I'm guessing that'll start appearing in whatever episodes they have out. And I shot a video for History Channel for an Area 51 special that will be out. I've been producing a lot.
When you did this Area 51 thing, did you go up to Area 51?
No, not this. This was shot for me in New York City. For most of these TV documentaries, I think the majority of the sit-down interviews I have are either in L.A., that's the number one place, that's where most of the production companies are, or secondarily New York. Me being in New York State, it's a lot easier for me to get to most of the time. So, in fact, for this one, I just drove from Rochester to New York City. That's a drive I do frequently enough anyway, but it's a number of hours. You got to, haul it across the state. But they set me up in Manhattan, and it was actually a really nice experience. I always make sure that I'm as super prepared as I can be for any of these interviews. So I felt very good going into it, and I'm hopeful that when it appears, it'll be useful and engaging for people to watch.
Yeah. Now when we talk about Richard Dolan and these TV appearances, I notice a lot of your appearances at conferences all of a sudden are making the rounds on YouTube, at least parts of them.
Oh God.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm happy about it, to be honest with you. I my feeling is, look, the more if I have any message to give, the more that it's out there, the better. There was a period in the early 2000s, say like up to 2005, 06, when it was kind of a neat little thing when I would be able to sell DVDs of various lectures and people would buy them. And they'd be like, "Oh, Richard Dolan on DVD. Oh, let me get that." Now, no one buys them. Everything's on YouTube. And I thought, well, that was fun while it lasted. But honestly, it's way better like this. First of all, I'm not in this to make the buck. I'm in this to do a certain amount of work, to do a lot of work, and to get a message out and to communicate whatever it is that I may have to say. And YouTube is such an ideal medium for that. Honestly, I find clips of myself on YouTube that I had no idea was out there. I just ran across a clip. Someone pointed it out to me a week ago, less than that, of an interview I did about a year ago at the first International UFO Congress that was held in Phoenix after it was moved over. I did a nice 38-minute interview. I'd absolutely forgotten all about it. And here I am looking at it. It's a nice high def. It was a good sound quality. It was a nice interview with the interviewer. And so what I did is what I always do is I put it up on my Facebook page and said, "Here, people, take a look." Didn't know that this was out there. I'm always very happy to see, as long as it looks like it was a reasonably good interview, I'm very happy to get it out there. But the truth is I almost never watch my own interviews. There are people who know what I say much more accurately than I remember what I've said, to be honest with you. I'll do an interview, and then I'm done with it, and I try to move on to other things.
We both feel probably about the same way about yourself later. I mean, we've already seen ourselves when we did it,
exactly.
And at least we have an idea of what we did, but it doesn't hurt occasionally to check in.
You say what you
and
say.
See how you really look.
Yeah, and you move on, and that's what I always try to do. And for myself, too, I never want to get into a position where I'm saying the same thing year after year. I don't want to ever be that way. So what I always do, in fact, very consciously, is I try to evolve new themes for each year. What do I want to talk about? What do I want to focus on more in public presentations this year as opposed to last year? And I've noticed there's a definite evolution in the things that I talk about. So when I'm done with a topic, it's not that I forget about it, but the fact is that I'm usually busy focusing on new areas of interest, new areas of research that I feel are important. So I don't really have a whole lot of time, honestly, to study a lot of my interviews. And I don't want to say shocking. It's startling sometimes when I meet with people who know the things that I've said better than I know, which does happen.
Well, you have to take that as a compliment. That means you're doing good work.
I hope so.
These people are getting interested.
Well, there's a lot.
What's the topic du jour for 2012? You said you're interested in different things. Are you trotting out something new this year? Or
I'm writing a new book.
To talk about?
I've got a new project, which I'm very excited about. This came about initially as a request to teach an online university course on UFOs. And it's for it's an online university called the International Metaphysical University, or IMU. They're not accredited for college yet, but they are working on it. I think they've got a nice kind of program going there. And really what they do, as you might imply from the name, is that they deal with a variety of topics that are just a little off the beaten path from standard university curriculum. And they wanted to have a curriculum in ufology or UFO research. Didn't really have one, and ended up asking me if I would develop the course for an introduction to ufology, kind of the foundation for it. So I thought about
it. Kind of a ufology 101, huh?
Exactly. And really what they need is 12 distinct classes, 12 distinct lectures on topics of my choosing in the field. So I agreed to do it, and this was last summer. And I looked at it as an opportunity to think through the issues of ufology in as fresh a way as I could. And, you know, what is it about this topic, this field, this discipline that I personally have considered to be really the important key elements of the field? And so it gave me an opportunity to sit down and really, with as fresh an approach as I could, try to think this through. And so I've started to do it. And what I realize is that each lecture really is equivalent in length to a standard chapter of a book. And so what I've decided to do is I'm doing a lecture series and I'm turning it into a book as well. And that's more than halfway done now. And I expect it will be completely done in a couple of months at the most. And then I'll publish it and get it out there. So it's for the course, an introduction to ufology for this online university, IMU. I think I'm calling the book UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. That's my current working title. I think I may like that. And I think it sort of captures what I'm trying to do for this book. It's an attempt to give really what I want it to be is ideally the first best book for anyone who wants to learn about the UFO topic. If someone doesn't know anything, this should be the book for them. That's my goal. And I certainly intend it for experienced readers as well, as a new way to kind of reconfigure and synthesize what we know today about this topic, or what we think we know. This is not.
I got an email already, Rich. Somebody wants you to go over the details on that Internet University again, how they get involved in that.
Oh, well, by all means.
They're very interested in that.
That's
evidently.
Good.
Yeah, it is good, and I think it's a great idea.
It's called the International Metaphysical University. You can probably Google that. You'll get right to their page. I am listed on there as faculty, although the course is not yet live. So I'm doing a little search on it right now. Here we go. International Meta. It's intermetu.com. So it's a bit of an acronym. If you just Google International Metaphysical University, you'll get there. And you can kind of scroll on through there.
What is involved in that? Do you watch your lecture and do you get study guides or something?
Exactly. So I'll have 12 lectures which will be in audio form. I'll also be creating them as video, which will have visuals to go along with them, because I'll really need that. It's really like a college course. I'll create study materials. I'll be live online with people at least once a week for an hour or more per
session.
Yeah,
do you have a certain time to do that?
Well, I've got to create office hours, I guess. I'll have to set all that up, but that's part of the program, is that the student will have one-on-one.
So it's something we need to start paying attention to. And when you get that out and work out them when you're doing it.
It's funny.
Keep me abridged.
Yeah, I will. Before I got into the UFO field, I was working on a PhD at the University of Rochester, which, by the way, I've decided I think I'm going to at some point go back and finish that PhD in some form. But I taught courses at the University of Rochester, and I enjoyed it very much. This is long before I did UFO studies. So this will give me an opportunity in some way to get back into that groove a little bit and actually have some students and guide them along into this, you know, complicated, labyrinthian topic in many ways. It's, hopefully provide some good guidance and encourage creative thought on the process.
Well, you know, there's something enchanting, and maybe that's an unusual adjective to use, but enchanting about your approach, and Stan Friedman does the same thing, an intellectual examination of UFOs, and others do as well. If I start naming people, I'll leave somebody out. But you were quite a history guy anyway.
That's my study. Yeah. That's my discipline, exactly.
And so as a result of that, I think that's part of the charm of Richard Dolan is you're intellectual, yet you've got a good personality.
Well, thank you very much, Jerry. I do feel like for the field that we are in here, at least the UFO field, there's a lot of room for all kinds of ways to approach it. And in other words, there's room for people who are just very creative and speculative, because we need speculative people to help think outside the box in this very mysterious field. But I strongly do feel that it's necessary to have individuals who have rigorous training, because it's very easy to get lost at sea in the study of ufology. It's very easy to forget what constitutes valid evidence. It's very easy to kind of get hooked into groundless speculations. And I think it happens in this field just about every single day now, in particular with the advent of Facebook and social networking. It's like everyone is talking to everyone. In many ways, that's a great thing. But unfortunately, I think part of the downside is that places like Facebook and YouTube and elsewhere can be like a rumor mill. So certain things go viral, they spread, and the next thing you know that old game in elementary school where you'd whisper into someone's ear, and then they'd whisper into the next kid's ear, and then it goes around the room, and by the time it gets back to you, it's something totally different. And that's kind of what happens every single day in the field of ufology. And there are certainly people who really live for that. They live for the drama. I don't live for the drama. I simply am trying to investigate and understand the greatest mystery of our time. There's enough drama in that so that I don't have to invent any extra.
Were you always interested in UFOs, Richard?
Yes and no. More no than yes, to be honest with you. I was born in 62. I grew up, in my like early teens. I used to watch Star Trek like everyone, and I was a big fan of the old Star Trek show. I used to watch Leonard Nimoy's In Search Of series when I was in my early teens, and I did think that was very cool. I remember thinking some of the ancient astronaut episodes that he did were very, very interesting. But I didn't have books on the topic. I didn't pursue it. I was into really science and baseball when I was growing up, and a little bit of history. As I got through my teen years, I got really into history. I lost all interest in any of the Star Trek-y kinds of things that I may have grown up in. Through my 20s, it was even more so. I was focused totally on political history, intellectual history, philosophy, literature, and so on. And it wasn't until my early 30s, and this would be now by the early 1990s, mid-1990s, that I became – it was a crazy thing, Jerry. It was in 1994, and it was as though within a period of a month or two, I went from zero to being obsessed. I mean, not even interested. I would say obsessed. It was a dramatic turnaround in my life. And it wasn't caused.
Can you pinpoint why that happened?
Well, not 100%. I mean, there were two moments that I distinctly feel were important. One was a moment in a bookstore where I saw a copy of Timothy Goode's Above Top Secret. And that was an important moment. And of course, that's a real classic in the field. The subtitle of that book, which was what really got me, was the Worldwide UFO Cover-Up. And it's a nice big fat book, and it was sitting on a display in a store. And I picked it up. Now, that book had been out for some time by then, but it was new to me. And I just remembered thumbing through the book. And immediately, for anyone who's seen the book, they know it's a well-put-together book. There's a lot of documentation. There's a lot of international stories involved and a lot of political figures, people that I knew about, guys whose diaries I had read or listed in the book, departments I'd studied. And that moment was one of a tremendous cognitive dissonance for me personally. It was basically, here's me, who I thought I was ahead of the curve in understanding how my world worked and how everything was put together. And I'm encountering this reality here that was so radically different. You don't study UFOs in the academic world, not in any serious way. It just isn't done, hardly at all. But here is a book that was essentially telling me that my worldview was either totally wrong or woefully inadequate. And I can tell you, it wasn't a fun thought to entertain. No one enjoys that thought, especially if you become very serious on a certain track and your goal is to understand the world and ideally to teach history, which was my goal at the time. Yet I bought the book, and I could not help but be persuaded by the presentation. The other thing that really was equally important, and maybe more important at a certain point, was the early internet. Now, in 1994, there was no web really to speak of that was worth browsing. But there were news groups. There were quite a few of those. And I used to hang out on one group that was Alt Paranet UFO. I'm sure there are people out there who remember this. And in the early mid-90s, it was a happening place. There were a lot of people who would post articles and put their ideas up there. And there was one fellow up there who really, I have to say, showed me how to do this. He's not a researcher that people know. He's a guy who lives in Missouri, Columbia, Missouri. His name is Val Gurman. He's a friend of mine to this day. Val is a guy who was always sort of a amateur, I mean, in the best sense of the word. He didn't really want to go into this and do conferences or write books. But he wrote articles that looked at ufology in a political, with a political analysis, with a good political analysis. And I thought, bingo, that is what I want to do. That's what I need to do. And at that moment, that with Tim Goode's book, I thought, I want to do the UFO topic. I want to do it right, and I want to do it with an appropriate political analysis, analyzing the cover-up. And really, I mean, it's crazy to say this now, almost 20 years later, but at that time, there really was almost nothing in UFO literature, if you really go back, that did any true analysis of the cover-up. In fact, there was none. There was a book called Clear Intent on the UFO. And really, but what that did was it threw out a lot of the Freedom of Information Act documents that showed that there was strong interest, and that's important. But there was no analysis. And so what I tried to do is to set out to do exactly that. And now I think that there is a number of people who are trying to do that, and I'm one of them. But in the early 90s, mid-90s, there were really no good examples that I had to work off of that tried to do this on a consistent basis, except my friend Val, who put out a couple of very good articles. And as I say, he kind of showed me, opened the path. I'll always be grateful to him for that.
Richard Dolan is our guest, and we're talking naturally about UFOs and the conspiracy and the cover-up and a few other things that Richard's interested in. And I've already had a couple of emails at jerry@jerrypippin.com. We have several people in the chat room. We'll probably go to that as well, Rich, before we let you off.
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned the cover-up and the conspiracy angle and everything just before I did my little spiel here.
Mm-hmm.
And while you were talking about that, I kept thinking about the whitehouse.gov website, and you and Bryce Sable put up something in December as well.
That's right.
How did that go? Did you get very many people interested? I mean, your question was actually pretty straightforward. You said, why don't you investigate, I guess, basically is what you asked.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't we investigate? I mean, no, I guess that's in response to them saying they don't investigate.
Right, exactly. The petition was, the White House is only since September of this last year allowed for a process of giving petitions, of creating a petition for the government. Before September of 2011, there was no website that the White House had that allowed for this. Now, it was our friend Stephen Bassett of Paradigm Research Group who really saw this opportunity, and Stephen put out the first petition in October. He didn't waste a whole lot of time, got one out there, and basically to demand the White House recognize UFO phenomenon as ET. That got over the minimum amount of 5,000 signatures, so the White House was forced to reply. They gave a pretty lame reply, but really what else are they going to say, honestly? During the process of that petition, they upped the minimum amount from 5,000 to 25,000. And you got to think, holy smokes, that's five times the initial amount that they put out there. So by the time Bryce and I decided to do one, and for us it was a last minute thing. We had not really planned to do a petition, I'll be honest with you. We did it because Steve Bassett wrote to both of us in preparation for his second petition, and we were two of the people that he consulted with over the language of his next petition. And really, Bryce and I just talked privately, and we thought, you know, we could do a petition. So why don't we do one? And we felt that the one we had was a very appropriate one, and it just, as you mentioned, it was a call for the White House to investigate unknown aerial phenomena. We didn't even say UFOs. We said UAP, which we stated has been an issue within the national security community for years, and that we wanted a transparent investigation, materials declassified, and the findings made public. That was essentially what we demanded. So we put the petition out there. It started off with a fair amount of steam, and it trailed off. So we got about 2,000 signatories. And incidentally, Bassett on his second one got only a little bit more than that. So both of our petitions were essentially dead in the water. Part of the problem was that we had huge numbers of people emailing us saying, what is wrong with the White House website? I've tried and tried and tried to register. They won't let me register. I keep getting kicked out. This went on for the entire month, Jerry. I really have no idea, but it would not shock me if we lost 1,000 signatures or more. There were so many people who just gave up trying because the White House website wouldn't allow them to
sign up.
It was a lot, and it was disheartening, to be honest with you, because we really thought we had something that was worthwhile there. The White House, what they say is, well, it really was a glitch. We're sorry about it. There's not much we can do about it. You can try again next time. That's essentially where we're at. The petition period, you get 30 days to get the signatures necessary. If you don't get it, it's gone.
You know, on the Internet, and I've been broadcasting on the Internet for some time, people just kind of gloss over the idea. If you go to a website and something doesn't work, you lose a huge percentage of the people.
Yeah,
they don't hang around.
Right.
And that's always been a problem, and sometimes techies don't seem to understand it.
Well, we were frustrated in one sense because this is during the month where, of course, the famous incident of the police officer pepper spraying members of Occupy Oakland, you know, just sprays them and walks by. And so you get all these people talking about this and people really going out there and sacrificing themselves for a certain cause. And we're thinking, well, my goodness. So there's an occasional glitch with the website, and for this issue of disclosure or getting government announcement, we can't even get people to just stick around and fight with a website for a little while. But you're exactly right. folks will go so far, they'll play with the website.
I mean, we've been doing this for well over a decade, and we still have problems, and it drives me nuts when it happens.
Sure.
Let's go to some phone calls, okay?
Mm-hmm.